Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Welcome. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. How about yourselves?
Yeah, not too bad.
Very good.
We've got some pretty cool topics with us today. I was having a little look earlier before. Did you want to get into this first one?
Yeah, right. So this is a bit of a history as well as a science here for this first one. So in the summer of 1812, Napoleon Bonaparte, so the French emperor, he basically assembled an army of over 500,000 soldiers because he wanted to invade Russia, which hasn't typically gone well for most armies.
Yeah.
And didn't go so well in this, this campaign didn't go so well either, because by December of that same year, so just a few months later, most of that army was dead. Like, it's reported that fewer than 50,000 survived.
Yeah, okay.
So, and basically historical records have said that it was probably a combination of starvation, that it was really, really cold, and typhus, trench fever, dysentery.
Napoleon, he was the French guy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I know a lot, but I don't know a lot about
him. Same. Yeah, we all know of him, but do we really know him?
That he was short, that it was a myth? I don't know.
I think the whole short thing is actually a myth.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. I heard that, because I've heard different things about his height. People said he was really short, but then people said, oh, he was just averagely short, whatever that means. So
yeah.
I think
averagely short.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway. And I think I haven't seen it, but I think there was a movie in the recent times as well that was a bit out of his life.
Oh, I saw it. It was terrible. It was really long. Oh, okay. I fell asleep.
Yeah. There we go. So I won't recommend that then.
There's new evidence about this army.
Yeah, basically, so there's more to the story right now. So these scientists have the coolest descriptor I've seen. So if someone asked me what sort of scientist I am, I'd say a spectroscopist, because I use and study spectroscopy.
Right.
These scientists are called microbial paleogenomicists.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, rolls off the tongue, right? Basically, it means they study the genetics of ancient microbes.
Okay.
So I thought that was very cool. But what they've done is there is a site in Lithuania and it's in this place called Vilnius, Lithuania, where there's this mass grave of these soldiers from this campaign. And it's been used in the past to study, to have scientific studies of these soldiers and what's left over them to understand more about what happened to this army. And that's where they've gone, and they've basically taken teeth from 13 soldiers buried in this grave. So previously it was basically this evidence for what had caused all this death has come from doctor and army officer accounts, where they suggested that these soldiers were suffering from this typhus, which was common at the time. Previous studies have also, they found body lice, which is how typhus is spread.
Right.
And then they'd also done some DNA work, which found DNA for Rickettsia prosaici. Microbes have hard to pronounce names. And this is the bacterium that's responsible for typhus. In this grave, they'd also found evidence for another microbe called Bartonella quintana, which was for trench fever. And so these were the things that previously they thought had led to death. Well, what these scientists in this study were able to do is they're able to use the new genomic technology that we have, right? So these previous studies had used something called polymerase chain reaction. And this is really good if you know what you're looking for. Mm. But the ancient DNA techniques that we have now, you can use, they kind of cast a wider net. So you can, you don't need to have some idea of what you're looking for. You can try and just see what's there, kind of thing.
Right, okay.
And what they didn't find was typhus, which was a bit interesting. But what they did find was evidence of Salmonella enterica, which causes enteric fever. And another one that was called Borrelia recurrentis, which causes relapsing fever, which is also transmitted by body lice.
Are these quite, is this different to what, like significantly different to what they thought?
Yeah, so it's kind of, so they did go, okay, what's this discrepancy? Like, why aren't we finding typhus and trench fever and these other things? And so the reasoning for them finding the Salmonella enterica and these Borrelia recurrentis is probably because of this new technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that typhus wasn't there, but that just in the samples that they got, that wasn't there kind of thing. So, you know, like it would be, you could maybe go back and sample from a different area of the mass grave and you find people that had that. So it's kind of this, it's just adding to the story. There was a lot more than one thing, right?
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, back in the day when you had these doctors and army officers, people would just get fever, right? And they'd just be sick. So they'd just go like typhus or trench fever. Like they couldn't really tell the difference because they didn't have the genomics that we have now, right?
Yeah, so they're painting a better picture of what's happened, I suppose.
Exactly, right?
Oh,
yeah.
Cool, okay. Great. Let's go on to our next topic. We've got pill-sized bioprinters. Now, I don't quite understand what a bioprinter is. I'm guessing... No, I'm not guessing anything. I know what the two parts of the word mean anyway.
It probably is kind of what you're thinking. So if you think about... We know 3D printers now. They print in plastic, polymers.
Yeah, right.
And so a bioprinter is the same idea, but your polymer now is something that's biologically compatible.
Okay. What's an example of that?
So you can extract polymers from, like, seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
And you can basically have like a gel kind of thing that you can print, you know, you squeeze out, extrude kind of thing and print into a shape. A few weeks ago, we talked about the hot glue gun for
For like mending bones.
Wow,
yeah.
Hot gluing bones together.
Yeah, so that was kind of like a really basic form, kind of a little bit like the idea that we're going to talk about here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like it was that same idea in that case because it was bone. They were using hydroxyapatite, which is the mineral of your bone, and basically pushing it through a nozzle so that you could print a three-dimensional shape kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the hot glue gun was literally like just connecting the two ends of the bone.
Right.
Okay. So it's that idea, right? It's just, it's a polymer or the material that you're printing with has biological compatibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can use it as a scaffold so that you can have cells in it already, or you can have other stuff in it, like antibiotics or medications and stuff. And so that your tissue, whatever that tissue is, can grow onto it or repair itself.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's pill-sized.
Yeah, so this one...
I can't even conceive of how that's possible.
This is kind of mind-blowing. So they had there was this bioprinting aspect of it, but there's also this other sort of technology that they took ideas from, which is called untethered technology.
Yeah.
Now, untethered technology is medical devices that you basically use to do different procedures or interventions without needing a connection to external equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about if your upper GI tract, like your stomach, your esophagus kind of thing is investigated, they might put an endoscope down your throat, like so you have to have they put you to kind of sleep. You don't really know what's going on.
Yeah, right.
And it goes down your throat and it's got a little camera on the end and they can have a look around. They can take biopsies and stuff. But it's connected to something outside your body.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, if you can have something that's not connected to outside your body, maybe it's easier to implement. So they have these things called, they're not used yet medically, but there's research going on called pill cams. So it's like a thing you swallow.
Oh, you like swallow a camera?
And it has a camera and it can...
Stop.
Like,
wow, wait, that's so smart. So,
but right, like...
So cool.
But it's just like... It's just surfing the wave kind of thing. It's going through the fluid and so there's not a lot of control.
Yeah, that's so true.
In this case, what they've done, which is quite clever, is they've taken this idea of having this bioprinter and this untethered technology, but they've also done something that some other people have done where if you put a magnet on your device that you swallow and you have basically a robotic arm with a magnet outside, you can start to control where it goes a wee bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
that's cool.
So the way these scientists describe their tech is it's like a ballpoint pen. And so when you push on the top of your ballpoint pen and the tips comes out and then you can write kind of thing. Mm. Well, in these, it's got a spring loaded and when you activate it, it will push out this biopolymer. So what happens is when we say it is a large pill, I'm not sure I would like to try swallowing it. It's about the size of kind of your thumbnail in terms of height. And they didn't actually put actual dimensions, but kind of a bit bigger than a jelly bean, right?
Yeah, right.
So you're going to have to swallow that.
That's quite big. Usually I think a little.
So it's within the range of, I think, the size of tablets you can get, but it's on the larger side.
Mm.
So you swallow it. You use what's called X-ray fluoroscopy. So it's basically you take a video with using X-ray so you can see how the pill is traveling down the GI tract.
I was going to say, I could be completely off. Is it like when you're at the dentist and you get a picture, an x-ray taken, you put the thing in your mouth and you bite on it and then it takes the picture with a bit of plastic in your mouth? Is it
so that's,
like that?
That's like a still image, right? Yeah, so you get the one image. Mm-hmm. What this does is it... taking multiple, so it's like a video.
It's like a GoPro that goes... It's like a pill GoPro that goes...
This x-ray is outside your body, so it's following where the pill is, because the pill has got metal in it, right? So you can really see it in the body. So the reason you're doing that is because you want to know... In this case, they were looking at ulcers, so that's in your stomach. Mm. So you want to know when it hits your stomach, and then once it's there, you activate your magnet and you move it around so that you get it to about... Like if we think about stomach ulcers... get it to the area that it needs to be, and then they used a near-infrared laser, which can get through your skin and everything, aimed it at the little pill. That basically activated the printer. Something in the device happens, and the spring lets go, and it starts pushing out the biopolymer, and then using the magnet, you can kind of move it back and forth over the area that you want to cover, and you can basically print the biopolymer over the area.
That's how do people come up with this stuff?
That's so that clever. Is crazy.
It's very clever, right? And then they use the magnet to basically reverse the pill back out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
So you have to go, right, come on, get it out.
So this hasn't been done in humans yet. This is so they've done this in the lab using just simulated ulcer for simulated gastric ulcers, and so this is that stomach ulcers and hemorrhages, just to show that they can control and the biopolymer is released as you would. And then they've done it in rabbits, so they were able to show that their pill, which they call a magnetic endolumal deposition system, that it can actually, they can steer it for, you know, that's true. And that it will release, and so they did show that the bio-ink that they're using, their biopolymer, did maintain structural integrity for over 16 days. And so they like, you know, we could dope this with growth factors and drugs and stuff and make this better. And yeah, so I think, watch this space.
Watch this space. Yeah. This is quite, probably not a similar thing at all, but quite related in a way to our next topic. With mushroom memory chips.
Yeah.
How is that going to work? They reckon that's going to... it says for future computers.
Yeah, so this is wow.
That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, one of these real like science fiction ideas.
Yeah, real sci-fi episode today.
Yeah, it is really. So fungi, like, they're just amazing. They're extremely resilient. They have a lot of unique properties, and so this is where it's led to this field of science that I have just learned about this week called fungal bioelectronics.
Wow.
And the whole idea is to use fungi for electronic devices, because fungi have electrical properties.
Do they actually?
Yeah. And so you get the mycelial network, which is how, like, basically with fungi, they have like tentacles, arms kind of thing, and they spread out, they can cover lots of big areas, and they do actually communicate, or they carry electrical signals. And so you can use this capacity for these mycelial networks to carry electrical signals, perhaps in computing devices, and this is what they're looking at. And why would you be interested?
Yeah.
Because they're biodegradable, right? They could be self-healing, they don't perhaps use a lot of power, so these potentially future applications where these could be quite useful. But obviously there's a lot to work out and understand and do beforehand. So it turns out this has actually been an area of research for quite a while. The study that led me to finding out that there was such a thing as fungal bioelectronics was one that looked at using button mushrooms and shiitake mushrooms.
So edible ones.
Yep. Be a good lab group to be a member of, I think. basically what they did was they grew the mushrooms, and then once they matured, they actually dehydrated them just so they would last a bit longer in their studies. And then they had some electronic circuits that they had made, and they basically connected those electronic circuits to their petri dishes of their mushroom material. And they electrocuted them at various voltages and frequencies.
Oh, are you sure you want to be part of this study? I think I would.
And they also changed where they connected the electrical wires, because different points of the mushroom had different electrical properties. And so what they found is, depending on where they put the connections and the voltage, they saw the different performance, like different responses from these shiitake mushrooms. So they basically were saying like they could train them to be an organic MEM resistor. And what this is basically a data processor that remembers past electronic states. So this is something you need in computing, right? Mm. And so they kind of did an experiment where they basically used their shiitake mushroom device in a way like you would use the RAM in your computer. And they showed that they could switch between electrical states at a rate of 5,800 signals per second with about 90% accuracy. Now, I meant to go look up see what RAM actually did, but I forgot to.
Yeah, it's all over my head.
Yeah, and so, but from this, it did seem like this was much better than they thought they would get, given that they literally just put some wires into the mushrooms. Like, they didn't do anything really complex here. And what they found is if they increased the frequency of the electrical voltage, they did see a performance drop, but if you just added some more mushrooms, performance went up again.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And they kind of made the analogy that this is something similar to what you do in your brain, with like your brain does with neurons and stuff. And so while they did say this is very much early development, it's kind of, it's to me, it's really freaky and quite exciting, this idea of that you could just use fungi in some parts of, or specific, I would say it's be particular types of computing, right? They're not going to, you're not going to end up with mushrooms in your cell phone in your pocket kind of thing.
Oh, shame.
But yeah, there's a lot, there's obviously, they think, you know, if they could optimize the cultivation, certainly need to miniaturize. At the moment, this was just an experiment where they were literally were petri dishes full of the mushroom material that they stuck wires into. Wow. Like, the picture's pretty cool.
Yeah. So eventually mushroom supercomputers or future computers. I don't know. This is a, distant future. I never imagined this one.
It seems very science fiction, but true.
Yeah, right on. Well, that is all of our topics today. Thank you so much, Krishla, for joining us. As always, thank you, Motat, and thank you, Science. That is the show today.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.